When it comes to compact construction equipment, Takuchi is a globally trusted brand. The famous red and grey machines you see everywhere are built to perform on any site, delivering power, precision, comfort and reliability from 1 to 15 tons. Now offering a lineup of proven compact track loaders, versatile tool carriers for construction and highways. Choose machines that work as hard as you do. Visit Takuchi-mfg.co.uk to find out more.
It's Wednesday, the 21st of January, 2026, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, reviewing some of the industry news from the past couple of weeks. Now, it's been a busy couple of weeks for news, Phil, but I've been distracted by all those goings-on on the other side of the Atlantic, so forgive me if I haven't paid enough attention.
Oh, let's not. let's stick to the UK construction industry rather than...
Yeah, which is relatively mild in comparison. So what are we discussing this week?
Well, there's lots we could talk about, but what I think we've focused on is we want to talk about... Graphene is always an interesting material to talk about on the back of a collapse of one of the pioneers in the construction sector. Then there's an important legal case we're going to talk about.
Yes.
And then an interesting plant hire or plant dealership that's been set up.
Yes.
Leaders of private eye might be particularly interested in.
Yeah, certainly.
So that's our agenda today.
Okay, let's start with graphene then.
I should just forward it. Listeners may wonder why we're not talking about the two big government papers of the week, which is the water white paper and the warm homes plan. But I think everyone else is talking about them, so we're trying to stay slightly left field because we're happier in the left field, aren't we?
Yeah, I think so. I think we can certainly talk about those things, later on when more has come out about them. But I mean, the Warm Homes Agency sounds like old wine in a new bottle, if you ask me. But
the whole thing Green Deal Mark Five or whatever.
Yeah. Well, anyway, graphene's far more interesting. But I was surprised to see that this company, Vesarion, I don't know how you actually pronounce it, but it went
into... Yes, this is our news pet, Vesarion. I thought it was a Joseph Heller character, but of course that's Yosser, not Vesarion.
Yes, that's right, yeah. This is a different catch.
Yes, so the news peg is that this company called Vesarion, not very big, but AIM-listed, went into administration 6th of January, so 2 weeks ago now. Thought it'd be worth discussing for a little bit what this might mean. Does it mean that the construction industry is not particularly interested in graphene, not ready for graphene? Because it's one of two or three companies with graphene products aimed at the construction industry.
I suppose, Phil, we should mention, for the sake of people who might have missed this, what graphene is. I mean, just as a brief overview, it's this carbon nanotechnology which was developed at the University of Manchester, I believe, about 10 years ago, something like that. It's all very
discovered. I think it was always there. They just found it.
Yeah, yeah. It's got remarkable properties. I mean, you can... specifically in the construction context, it can increase strength of concrete mixes quite considerably. I think I read 30% somewhere. And I think a lot of people have paid a lot of attention to it because it seems to promise so much. But if it promises so much, why has this company, Vesarion, collapsed? And also, why has it never managed to make any money? It's been losing money hand over fist ever since it was set up.
Well, there's an awful lot of hype about graphene when it first emerged 22 years ago. And it was immediately thought, yep, they can do all this, that and the other. Everything from construction materials to the clothes that we wear, clothing or whatever, and all sorts of materials. You mentioned its strength properties. It's not just that. I mean, what people are very interested about at the moment is the fact that it can be used in tiny quantities as a substitute, a partial substitute for more carboniferous ingredients of concrete. So that 30% I've seen that 30% figure used as its ability to reduce the embedded carbon in concrete, CO2 emissions. And it's been tried. Yeah, Vesarion particularly, their product was something called cementine. And they reported on a demonstration 3 years ago that Banagher precast concrete, you can remove 20% of ordinary Portland cement and replace it with cementine to get huge, great savings and great performance and this, that and the other. And Vesarion have been involved in various government-funded trials. It's worked with the Skanska Costain Strabag joint venture on HS2 and other things. And lots of people have said, yeah, we're interested, we'll do it. But it's never made any... I think it was a sort of a, like so many of these companies, its origins are as a university spin-out or sort of research. Yeah. And they've always sort of relied on research grants, whether that's from government or from companies. And they've never actually, Vesarion for one, was never able to get over the line into that sort of become a commercial proposition. It was always just really interesting and exciting. And it could never, get to the tipping point. And there are a couple of others in the same sort of game in the construction sector specifically. There's a company called Concretine, which is, I think, was a spin-off from Moores, but it's part of the Manchester Technology Centre. And they've been doing work. They work with Arup, for example, and they're more to do with concretes used in the building sector rather than road paving. I think cementine. Actually, no, that's concrete, wasn't it, rather than road paving. The road paving one I'm thinking of is GIPAVE, I think.
Yes, that's Italian, I think. Isn't it?
It is Italian. Yeah. Maybe it's GIPAVE or GIPAVE. We've talked about them before. And they've been around for 5 or 6 years on various road projects. It's been trialed, and you could say 5 or 6 years is not long enough to see how long the road surface lasts and its long-term performance. So there's still studies going on. But GIPAVE and Concretine, they're still around, but they're not, they haven't taken over the universe in the way that in 2004 we thought graphene was going to. And I did actually drop an email to one of the founders of Concretine yesterday afternoon, because they're still around, saying, Is everyone facing these problems? Why has graphene not, reached the commercial tipping point to break through? And it's still just 20 years on, a sort of a research project. Unfortunately, I haven't heard back from them. I suspect they haven't given them enough time to respond. But do you have any thoughts?
Well, I just think it's probably... Maybe the whole sort of graphene thing has been jumping the gun, and that, it is, as you say, you've got... obviously, a highly technical development, something which was discovered very much in an academic research context. And people have just struggled to find, as you say, to make that link with the commercial world, to turn what is a wonderful idea into a really useful product for industry. And I think all these people are interested in it, like you mentioned, Balfour Beatty, Saint-Gobain, the French materials giant. They've funded graphene research. Roger Bullivant, the specialist in driven piling in the UK, they've experimented with, they tied up with Concretine to, improve the strength of their precast piles or something like that. People are very interested in it, but I think the thing is, you can't make it work. They just can't get it off the ground. So it's this lovely idea, but it's just not... you can't use it for anything.
But the idea, two things occurred to me. I mean, one, it's gone from being a strengthening agent to a carbon reduction agent. And that seems to be the selling point. And two is, I don't know anything about the costs here. And if it's just, a fabulous idea, but ludicrously expensive, maybe it's just not going to work. But I also, I don't know how long these things, I have got no idea. How long did it take Teflon to go from NASA to frying pans?
I don't know.
5 years or was that 30 years?
I think it was quite quick, actually. Non-stick frying pans have been around for a long time. I think, maybe they weren't around before Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, but they were certainly around very shortly afterwards. I don't know. I think there are lots of sort of technical things which sort of wow us with their potential, but we can't realize those potentials, really. I'm thinking of, do you remember it was something called potty putty? I think in America they called it silly putty.
Which was a
malleable, like it was like plasticine, but if you rolled it into a ball and threw it, it bounced. Well, that was really, it was a product or a material which was invented or discovered with wonderful properties, but all they could do was turn it into a toy.
Oh, they thought it had industrial applications, did they?
Yeah, and it might have done. I mean, I don't know if I think it was certainly it was something which was amazing. This was a malleable material which you could mold into different shapes.
But was it potty putty or was it the other one was slime in the sort of little green rubbish bin, which I also had. And its only function other than, it's not even a toy, is it? It's just something to fidget with, was cleaning keyboards.
I didn't know you could use it for that.
And car dashboards and, you know, crevices.
It's
good for that. But I've never seen office cleaners use it.
No, that's true. I think it's one of those things. It's just amazing. And you see it and you think, wow, this stuff is incredible. But what can we use it for? And you can't find a really practical use for it. This discussion reminds me of a conversation I've been having with a Dutch outfit very recently, and I'm planning to do something in the next issue of the magazine about it. Again, this isn't you know, brand spanking new. It's been around for a while, but it's a, you know, we're always talking about these cement substitutes, all these products and methods of replacing Portland cement, you know, and we all know that cement production or concrete production is responsible for 8% of man-made global warming emissions, all the rest of it. So everybody is falling over themselves to develop substitutes for cement. And this outfit, I don't think they're the only ones doing it, have developed a technique whereby they can actually take carbon dioxide. You know, we talk about CO2 capture and, you know, sort of, you know, that kind of thing. They extract CO2 from industrial processes, and then they actually mix it into their cement substitute mix. So basically, you're ending up, and they say, you know, this is actually carbon negative. We've got carbon negative concrete, finally, which sounds absolutely fantastic. And so I dug a bit deeper to find out how much of this stuff they can produce. And it is very much at the sort of... I was going to say experimental stage. It's not experimental, but it's at the trial stage now. But they're moving fast towards commercial production. But they can only produce, at the moment, about 200 and 400 kilograms per year of this stuff. So we ain't going to see it on building sites very soon. I mean, it's been used on sort of trial projects, but things like, you know, nothing is not going to be widespread.
This is where my tiny brain can't get my head around these sort of things, because I know one of the two things I remember from school science lessons, that we breathe in oxygen and we breathe out carbon dioxide. Uh-huh. So why can't you just get a stadium full of people, you know, just before the cup final, all to breathe into buckets of concrete, and that will all make it carbon negative? I mean, does that not work?
Well, it'd certainly be entertaining, but I'm not sure it'd be very efficient. Put it that way. Give everybody a balloon as they blow into this. No, I mean, it's, you know, it's great that people are doing these things. And I think that so long as we encourage this sort of research, and it is really ingenious, some of the things which are being done, we might actually be able to make an impact on sort of on global warming emissions. But at the moment, it's still so young as a technology. I mean, there are so many ideas that we haven't really found the one.
But I'm quite a consider myself politically sort of a classic Burkean small L liberal, and I, you know, with great belief in the market and market forces. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that if graphene was going to be a thing for the construction industry, either Saint-Gobain or Holcim or Heidelberg or one of these sort of big boys would have come along and said, "We're having you," and would have bought up at least one, if not all, of these little companies. They would have been scooped up, because it's, you know, if it was the future, the money would follow it, and they haven't. The money hasn't. It's just been subject to little, frankly, diddy squiddy grants here and there.
Yeah.
And by the market, I don't mean the pull factor. The contractors aren't. It's not so much that the contractors aren't demanding it, because contractors will use today what they used yesterday on the whole. Mm. It's the big money on the materials side. These big global companies, if they thought it, you know, they would be diving into it and pushing it on the construction industry.
And I think it's scale. Scale is the issue here. All these ideas, and graphene is one of these. They're small scale. They're sort of they're being developed on a trial basis at the moment. But the thing about
it's been 20 construction materials, or at least 15 years.
But I mean, obviously, it takes time to develop these things. And the thing is that you need, when I talk about scale, you know, construction materials are consumed and produced on a massive scale. I mean, I think we produce 30 billion tons of concrete a year.
So you only need 1% of that to have a huge business then, don't you?
I mean, 1% of 30 billion. That's still quite a lot.
Yeah. You don't need to take over the entire market. You just need to get in there.
Yeah.
You know, I say, and this particular company that's gone under, Viserion, they were founded in 2010. Hmm. You know, something should have happened by now. And if it hasn't happened by now, I worry that it won't ever.
Yeah. No, I think you're probably right. You know, there are people, obviously there are universities and research centres all around the world working on things like this all the time. I suppose you've just got to find something which is easy to scale up.
But until you get Saint-Gobain's money or Heidelberg's money or these people, and if you're just relying on little...
Well, as I said, Saint-Gobain, I think we reported it actually last year. Saint-Gobain have funded graphene research, but it's not like, you know, they haven't done what you suggested earlier, say, right, we'll...
Yeah, they've said,
here's a few million, you know, and see what you can do. I don't know how much their funding was and who they funded, actually. Come to that. I don't know who it was who they funded. But I think they probably thought, this is a nice idea. Let's encourage it and, you know, give them a few million, a million or two. But, yeah, not enough, really.
Anyway, it all seems kind of sad and frustrating.
It is a bit.
I bet the Chinese are going great guns with it. They're going to come out next year and say, you know, we've cracked it. Here you go.
I mean, I think that obviously the cost of this sort of development is extremely high. I mean, that must be why Viserion was losing so much money, losing more money a year than they were actually turning over at some point. So it must just be that it's, you know, the cost of developing something like this is astronomical.
There may come a, what do they call it, inflection point, tipping point, but...
Can't see it yet.
Not for construction yet, I don't think.
So shall we move on to our next topic, which is completely different, yes.
This court case.
We've talked about this before, actually.
Go on then. You
well, it's a saga, really. I mean, I think... I can't remember when we first reported on this. It was about 2 or 3 years ago, though. This was a case of a building developer called Hexagon and its contractor called Providence. And it was about one of those perennial problems, you know, contractual problems in construction. It was late payment. And Providence was building, I don't know, a block of flats or something somewhere in the south of England for Hexagon. And Hexagon, they'd signed a modified JCT contract. I think Hexagon had changed the payment terms so that they could pay in 28 days instead of 14. So that was the contract basis, but they still paid late. They just paid late all the time, over and over again. And Providence struggled with this. And as they pointed out, it wasn't just them that struggled with it. It was their entire supply chain. And so in the end, after there were two late payments, one in... I can't remember when it was. I think it was at the end of 2023.
2022, I've got.
Oh, was it? Okay, fine, okay. Well, it was around that time. Two late payments, and they said, no, enough is enough. And they invoked a clause in the contract which said that they could repudiate the contract. They could basically walk off site, which is what they did. And Hexagon said, no, you can't do that. And so it went to court. And I think contractors all over the country must have been indignant at the outcome because the Technology and Construction Court found in favour of Hexagon. They said, no, according to the contract, Hexagon wasn't in breach of the contract and Providence didn't have any right. They hadn't accrued the right to walk off site. And Providence wanted to appeal. First of all, they were denied the right to appeal. Then they got the right to appeal. And at the appeal stage, the court found in favour of Providence and said, you know, you can't, it's wrong and it goes against the spirit of the contract for Hexagon to basically abuse the payment terms.
Which is seen as a great triumph for construction contractors.
Yeah, it was.
Well, not the country. Scotland don't do, they have different laws.
No, that's true.
England, Wales over. Yeah.
But yes, and I think most of us are not construction experts and are not some legal experts. Most of us only have a sort of a nodding acquaintance with it, thank God. But I think most people would have said, yeah, that's right, that's justice. You know, you can't, because everybody knows in the industry that getting paid late is bad news and it's unjustifiable. And Hexagon was doing this on a really quite cynical basis, and it was sort of brinksmanship. They were leaving it till the last minute. The reason that...
It's also just plain stupid, because it risks... Providence is not a big company. It risks the viability of the financial welfare of the company.
Yeah. You know, Providence, and that affects the project.
Could have gone bust, and then, yeah, you know, it would have been the same result.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's difficult, unless you are somebody who's familiar with the JCT contract terms. There was a clause which said that if there are two defaults, then the contractor can walk off the site and can sort of repudiate the contract. But the fact that Hexagon had changed the payment terms from 14 days to 28 days meant that the second late payment was paid 14 days after it was due. So it was late by 14 days. And that's when Providence said, no, that we can't have this, and off they went. But the TCC, the Court of First Instance, said, well, actually, 14 days is within the 28 days, so they weren't in breach of contract. So even though it was late by 2 weeks, they weren't actually at fault until it was late by a whole month. And so that's what happened. And then now the latest story is that the Supreme Court, because it's Hexagon appeal, they took it to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has overturned the appeal court decision and backed the TCC's original decision and found in favour of Hexagon, which of course is very pleased with the whole thing. And so I think it's a rather sad story.
And contractors are pulling their hair out.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think it's basically unfair. It's one of these situations where, you know, the law has to be dispassionate about these things, and it has to look at the facts. And the facts of the case are basically whether or not parties to the contract were within their contract terms and they acted according to the contract. And the Supreme Court agreed with the Technology and Construction Court that Hexagon had acted within the terms of the contract and that Providence hadn't. And so although it seems totally unjustifiable, they couldn't make any other decision.
And unjust.
Yes, totally unjust, yeah. I mean, I can remember when the first decision was made, the chief executive or boss, I don't know what his role is,
Dan
Tancred, he's the owner of Providence. He went public with it, didn't he? And he sent out a really quite eloquent rebuttal of what the court had found. And he said that Hexagon had cynically and persistently ignored their payment obligations while expecting Providence to continue to perform its obligations to its full extent. Which is true and sounds entirely wrong to anybody with a sense of justice. And he also made the point, and this is him speaking after the original decision, which was subsequently backed by the Supreme Court. He said that ultimately this decision will be felt hardest by those at the bottom of the industry, being the contractors and employees working on site on a day-to-day basis, as poor payment provisions unfortunately has a trickle-down effect and will lead to a negative impact on cash flow and the contractor's ability to trade. You can't argue with that. It's true. And Hexagon should hang its head in shame, really. Yes, I'm sure it's totally smug and very pleased with the Supreme Court, because this is the last word in it. They won't, you know... Providence hasn't got anywhere else to go after this. But really, it's wrong. And I think that construction employers should be held to account, and they shouldn't be allowed to abuse a system like this. And I'm only quoting what people like Sir John Egan and who's the other one?
Latham.
But yeah, Latham said, you know, a couple of decades ago, everybody agreed. We've been the last 20 odd 30 years, we've grown up agreeing, and everybody, you know, putting their hands on their heart and saying, you know, we need to construct the team and work together, and you know, payment abuse is the worst offence. Not anymore. The Supreme Court says, yeah, you can do it. It doesn't really matter.
Yes, as you mentioned Darren Tankard. He was both after the original hearing and when he won the appeal, was very colourfully outspoken and articulate in putting his grievances across. He's saying nothing now. Now, whether that's because there's some, I almost think that maybe there's some sort of non-disclosure deal. I mean, obviously the legal judgment, or maybe he's just lost interest in going on, got other things, you know, other irons in the fire. Maybe some other reason altogether. I have no idea. But no, we've had no outburst from Darren Tankard on this.
No. Well, I imagine after all this, it's been dragging on for a few years, he's probably exhausted. You know, the Supreme Court's had the final say. That's it. I suppose if I were in his position, I'd say, well, I did my best, you know, draw a line under it and move on. So that's probably why. I mean, what's the point of banging the drum now? He can't do anything about it.
No, true. So, we're now back to where, Mr. Tankard said in the first place, it appears to be optional when you pay.
Yes. Yeah.
This is quite a fairly routine press release that I received from Case Construction Equipment, who, as you remind me, aren't American despite sounding it. They're actually Italian manufacturer.
Yeah.
And they've got a new dealer for the northeast of England and North Yorkshire, a company called EMH Plant, who I'd never heard of. And so I thought, well, who are they? You know, what else do they sell? It turns out they're pretty much brand new. And I looked at who owns them. I thought, those names are familiar. EMH Plant is ultimately owned by two chaps called, young men called Chester Corney and Tom Carr. They're both in their 20s. And they're the son and son-in-law, respectively, of a guy called Martin Corney, who's one of the owners of Teesworks Limited. And
that's where it gets interesting.
As readers, I'm not going to go into the ins and outs of the questions in the House and investigations that have gone on over what a good deal Martin Corney and his colleague, co-owner of Teesworks, got when they took over that site, and whether Ben Houghton was, Lord Houghton as he now is, was smart, stupid, or something else altogether in the negotiation of that deal. There is a very, very long and in-depth article that Private Eye published in, was it January this year? A special report. It's Google it. It's PDF, 9 pages, hugely in-depth. And one of the things it points out is the plant hire company, this is not EMH Plant, this new dealership, but it's a plant hire company set up by Chester Corney and Tom Corney, Tom Carr, the son and son-in-law of Martin Corney. How TCC Plant, its business is hiring out machinery, construction machinery, to contractors on the Teesworks site.
Only on that site, or do they?
I don't know.
Okay.
But that's the business model. That's where it's set up. In the latest accounts for them, they show that in the year to March 2024, and it had only been set, I think the company had only been going a couple of years by then. I need to check exactly when it was set up. But as I say, these are young lads, and it hasn't been going very long, this company. But in the year 31st of March 2024, it turned over £24.5 million. Pretty good.
Not bad.
It made a pre-tax profit of £9.8 million.
Cool, that's good.
Now, I don't think that any other construction, any other plant hire company in the country would make a pre-tax profit of 9.8 million on turnover 24.5 million. That is a phenomenally successful plant hire business.
Yeah.
Extraordinarily successful. I'll say no more than that. Anyway, they're now getting into the dealership business. They set up EMH Plant Limited, incorporated it in October 2024, with a former Molson sales manager. Ian Phillips is listed as the sole director at Company's House, but the ownership structure shows that, it's owned by vehicles which are ultimately owned by the TCC plant guys.
Right, Corney and Musgrave.
Tom Carr. The money is coming from, ultimately, it all seems to be wrapped up. It's another element of the whole wider Cheeseworks story, it seems to me. So it'd just be interesting to see how successful, if EMH Plant is half as successful as TCC Plant has been, we're going to see Yorkshire in the northeast flooded with Case excavators.
Yes, exactly.
Case machinery all over the place.
I don't really know much about the Case sort of network in the UK. I mean, presumably they have a network of registered dealers, do they, knocking around the country? And, I mean, presumably there will be, if the redevelopment, because I think that really this massive site in South Tees is still basically undeveloped. Presumably there'll be an awful lot of work to be done there. So they could make a lot of money just using Case equipment on site. But presumably they're going to be looking to sell this stuff further afield.
Well, that's what dealers do and seek to do. You'd imagine that if EMH is going to be selling machinery to TCC for use on, for TCC's hire fleet. Very confusing. We're talking about TCC in our last conversation.
Technology,
it's nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
But if TCC Plant is going to be buying Case machines from what is sort of a sister company, presumably be able to get them, at a good rate, a cheaper deal than perhaps other people are. So there might be something there. But if they want really cheap machinery, there's Chinese excavators, presumably, but maybe now with all these tariffs, I don't know where we are at with the tariffs on Chinese excavators, whether they've started or whatever. Mm. Maybe Chinese excavators aren't the bargain that they used to be with the tariffs.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe not. I mean, EMH Plant is a new business, you say. It hasn't been, so they haven't got any other dealerships.
Well, let's do a quick Google. I did look this up when I was first trying to find out who are they. They have a website, and emhplant.com. No, it just says new Case. Oh, this wasn't listed before, because they've got Case machines listed, and they've got a bunch of used machines as well.
Oh, right, okay.
So I think they started as a used plant dealer, I imagine, initially for TCC. I don't know.
Well, I have to say, Teesside looks like an extremely good place to go and do business because, there's an awful lot of money sloshing around, and it seems to be shared by relatively few people at the moment. So I think everybody should sort of beat a path to the Teesside door and see if they can set up a profitable business.
You don't think that market's already been
cornered? I don't know. There must be other opportunities. Speak to the right people. I think,
Anyway, if anyone else knows of a plant and hire company, that has been more profitable in terms of profit to turnover ratio, just repeat that, £24.5 million turnover, £9.8 million pre-tax profit.
It certainly is. Yeah.
In that business. There are plenty of businesses who have those sort of margins in the consultancy business, where you've got no assets.
Yeah.
It's all human, whatever, brain capital, rather than...
And plant hire is more profitable, generally speaking, than, say, contracting. So,
yeah,
I think
we've seen 15-20% margins, have we? Contracting, you talk about, 3% if you're doing brilliantly. But in plant hire, I think 15-20%. David, you in the magazine, you do a roundup once a year of... What margins, what profits are big plant hire companies. Dig that one out and see what do the likes of Flannery and so on. How do they get on compared to that?
Well, looking at what we do with this sector focus in every issue, we look at the what we think are the top 20, the 20 biggest companies by turnover in each sector, not necessarily the correct 20, but the ones which we think are the 20 biggest. Now, looking at November last year, when we last looked at plant hire, we totted up the total turnover of the top 20 plant hirers. It came to about £3.8 billion. And their profit, overall profit, was £273 million pre-tax profit.
That's about 7%, is it? Something like that?
Yeah.
Off the top of my head? Less than 10%, more than 5%.
I'm just scanning this at the moment, and let me see. P. Flannery Plant Hire are a very successful business. They had turnover in the year to March 2024. Their turnover was 221 million, and their profit, pre-tax profit, was 53.24 million.
Oh, so that's pretty blooming good, isn't it?
That's not bad. That's not bad at all.
50 million on 200 million in rough terms, 25%. Yep. That's not bad at all. Okay.
Selwood, what do they hire?
They're a specialist hirer.
Yeah, pumps. Well, they turned over 162 million and their profit was nearly 53 million.
Okay, so you can make good margins on that. But
yeah.
I still suggest that, you know, 10 million on 25 million it beats any of that, I reckon.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I can't see anybody doing better than that at the moment. Yeah, it's for a plant hire company that's only been going a couple of years, they've clearly got it right first time, haven't they?
They have. I wonder how they did it.
Yeah, I wonder.
Right, that's all I really wanted to had on my agenda to talk about. But you were asking me about why Mace is changing its name.
Yes, I thought this was a very interesting story, actually. Mace, as I think we discussed this not long ago, Mace recently sold its consulting business, Mace Consult, to Goldman Sachs.
No, it announced the sale of it. The deal hasn't closed.
Oh, it hasn't closed. Sorry.
That's still going through the works.
Yeah.
And so, a few years, relatively recently, Mace adopted these names, Mace Construct and Mace Consult, to distinguish its contracting arm and its consultancy arm. And Mace, remember its origins as a sort of Bovis, Lear and McGovern, you know, program management, construction management contractor.
And,
you know, they manage projects as a contractor rather than actually employing lots of people and do the actual contracting. And that was their roots. And they've grown in both directions from that, as a QS and as a contractor. Hence the Mace Construct and the Mace Consult arms of it. And they've both been hugely successful. And the Mace Consult business has gone international in a big way. Mace Construct has been involved in the Shard, most famously.
Yeah, yeah.
And they announced about 6 months ago, that they had agreed a deal with Goldman Sachs, the US bank, that some private equity fund of Goldman Sachs is going to buy most of the consult business.
Yeah.
I think some of the owners of the Mace Group, including executive chairman, as he is now, Mark Reynolds, and some of the other shareholders, are keeping some shares in Mace Consult to take part in its future growth. And I think at the time we assumed that that bit that was going might adopt some other name. But Mace announced this week that actually, no, it's the bit that's going that gets to keep the name Mace.
Yes.
Goldman Sachs have obviously decided that if they're buying Mace Consult, they damn well want the Mace name as well. And Mace Construct is going to have to go and find a new name, which it hasn't yet decided on. But it's going to tell us, well, it may have, but it's not telling us what it is. Later on this year, they're saying, once the deal with Goldman Sachs has closed and been absolutely finalised, we're going to tell you what our new name is. And I'm just looking forward to the description and explanation, because I love reading explanations of new brand names and how this name embodies and typifies our values of peace, love and friendship.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it'd be interesting. I think, in fact, we discussed this, and both of us had suggestions that they could simply get an anagram of Mace.
Like those engine people did. Who's the engine people that had a new name? They had an anagram of it.
Yeah, we discussed this last year, didn't we? I can't remember what they were called. Yeah, but it was... I should have looked that one up because, yeah, that would have been a perfect example. But I think you
just
move
a couple of letters on the Fawlty Towers notice sign outside.
That's right, yes. But I thought you could go down the Hanna-Barbera route, you know, with a Roadrunner and all the rest of it, and call it Acme Construct, because that has a sort of a generic term. And Mace has become almost a generic in the UK construction industry, that it's, you know, it stands for construction. But you had an even better idea, I thought, which was to revive a previous name, which is also an anagram of Mace, which is AMEC.
Oh, I thought AMEC. It was your idea. I didn't realize I suggested
I thought you suggested it. But AMEC, they were one of the biggest contractors in the UK back in the 90s, weren't they? They were massive.
And Sir Alan, was it Alan Cockburn, Cockcroft, Cockshaw?
Oh, God, I can't remember. But they were a big sort of infrastructure.
They were a big deal. Fairclough, they'd sort of grew
That's
out.
Right, yes.
And I always thought it stood for something because they wrote it in capital letters, but it never did. It wasn't. I thought it was Amalgamated Manchester Engineering Company.
It is something like that. Isn't it?
Are you
sure?
I once asked them, and they said, no, it's not amalgamated anything. It's just...
Well, hang on a second. I'm sorry, Phil, but you're outvoted by Wikipedia. Amalgamated Mechanical Engineering and Construction.
Oh, really?
When I tried to Google AMEC, I couldn't actually find a Wikipedia page for AMEC, which I thought was very odd. Because it only came up with AMEC Foster Wheeler, which is something which sort of came into being after AMEC.
Did Foster Wheeler acquire AMEC? Was that the story?
No, it was the other way around, I think. Oh. It's very convoluted. But yeah, AMEC, they had some tie-up with the French contractor, Spee Batignolles. And I think they might have bought out Spee or the other way around. Anyway,
Spee was someone else, wasn't it?
Don't know. Let me see. Again, I'm relying on Wikipedia here, which is...
Oh, okay, go with it. Okay, I've just Googled Spee Group, who still exists, their website.
Okay, yeah. Well, lots of just scrolling down through the Wikipedia entry for it, so many names pop out. Fleur, Colas, Morgan Sindall, Speedy Hire. There have been so many sort of links and crossovers and acquisitions and deals that anyway, the AMEC name I think has just about disappeared. I don't think anybody uses it anymore. So maybe it's probably owned by somebody, but maybe the people at Mace Construct could do a deal and rebrand themselves as AMEC Construct. We could see another revival of a respected British construction name.
I don't know. I don't see it happening.
they're probably paying at the moment they're probably paying some brand consultant millions of pounds to come up with a new name that, as you say, will embody their values and it will be inspire the industry.
It will be extraordinary. My guess is it will be almost unpronounceable. They'll have to tell us how to pronounce it. It will start with a lowercase letter,
yeah,
and it'll have an uppercase letter in the middle of it. And it may even have a heart over the eye.
Not sure they'd go that far, but yeah.
Like the Sarah Jessica Parker character in L.A. Story. Have you ever seen that Steve Martin film, L.A. Story?
No, I haven't seen that.
Steve Martin's getting fitted for some trousers and Sarah Jessica Parker's running around and she has to explain how to spell her name. And it's spelt in a very specific way with big letters and little letters and flowers and hearts as punctuation.
Yeah, well, that happens a lot. It might not happen in the trouser industry, but it certainly happens a lot in construction. People come up with wacky names and, yeah.
We'll see. Anyway, something to look forward to.
Yes, indeed.
Right, I've got nothing else. Anything else you want to talk about, David?
Was there something else? Let me just have a quick look. I think there might have been... No. I was going to mention the Warm Homes Agency, but we've already done them. I was going to say the Warm Homes Agency. I just saw that and I thought it was deja vu all over again. But we'll have to see how that pans out. Everybody's going to have a solar panel on their roof now. If any new home's got to have a solar panel on the roof. That's what it seems to boil down to, as far as I can tell.
I just received a press release from someone at I better check it. I think it's Burr Happold. I'm going to go out on a limb and say I'm sure it was, saying that, what do you call them, terraced homes, rows of terraced houses, are going to be a little bit tricky for a lot of this. So they need to, you know, work that one out a bit carefully.
Mm, yes, good point. And of course, if you're living in a flat or a high-rise block, you can't do any of it. You know, it doesn't affect you.
Put it on your window ledge, on your balcony, next to the satellite dish.
Yeah, I suppose you could do that.
Actually, no one has satellite dishes anymore. Just put it over the satellite dish.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Well, in which case, we'll be back again next month. It's February, yes?
I can't believe it, yeah.
Whizzing by. So thank you once again to you in particular for listening to us, and you know who you are. And we will be back next time. But from David and I, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.